I'm speaking with Professor Ben Saul. I thank you for joining me on the Israel Connection, Ben.
Good to be with you, David.
Now, in response to the accidental killing, widely considered to be an accidental killing of Zomi Frankel, the aid worker who was killed in Gaza just a week or so ago, the appointment of a special advisor by the Australian government, you believe is a wise, considered move. And you have pointed out that the Australian government has done this because it doesn't trust the integrity of the Israeli investigation. Do you want to perhaps elaborate on why you believe Israel should accede to such a request?
Look, I think the circumstances of the killings have obviously attracted global attention, including from the various countries whose nationals were killed. Obviously, lots of governments and countries are interested to get to the bottom of what happened. Israel's done the right thing, of course, in conducting a prompt investigation, which, of course, it's required to do under international humanitarian law, under the Geneva Conventions, when there's concern about violations of international law. I think the Australian government obviously believes that there are still potentially some unanswered questions there in the explanation given by the Israeli authorities. Israel itself has referred it to a criminal investigation by the military prosecutors in Israel. So for Israel, it's not the end of the story either. So I think if Israel does want to be transparent and demonstrate that it was a mistake, as it has said, then there's nothing to fear by having some kind of scrutiny or oversight by a close allied government like Australia.
Well, Australian National University International Law Professor Don Rothwell has said this appointment is unprecedented. Doesn't it open the door potentially to the interference of many countries in the internal affairs of other countries by going ahead with such a measure, which has really not been seen at all before?
You're right, it's unusual, although, of course, many countries do have military-to-military cooperation or law enforcement cooperation, including sometimes on joint investigations. To my mind, it's not an interference in Israel's internal affairs because it could only do anything with the cooperation of the Israeli authorities. So it's not like an Australian investigator can just show up in Israel and start investigating themselves. I mean, they've got to have the consent and cooperation of the Israelis. So it's for the Israelis to decide whether they want to do that. Secondly, I don't think it's an interference in internal affairs because under the Geneva Conventions, every country has an interest in the enforcement of international humanitarian law. So there's a provision, it's called Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions, which requires all countries not only to respect humanitarian law themselves, but to ensure respect by other countries for it. So it's well accepted under international humanitarian law that there's an international interest in the observance of humanitarian law. And if there are doubts about whether one country is respecting international humanitarian law, it's absolutely appropriate for other governments to take steps to be assured that it is being enforced in the way it should be.
Yeah, there are many other instances where countries like China let off the hook because it's deemed to be politically importune to really go ahead with such measures. In this case, no other nation who was affected, Canada, the United Kingdom, Poland, the United States, has announced any similar measures. The Biden administration says it's indicated that it's satisfied with what Israel has done. Isn't Australia really putting itself out on a limb, endangering its relationship with Israel by approaching it in this untrustworthy fashion?
Well, look, I think Israel has risked its relationship with Australia by not taking enforcement of humanitarian law seriously. I mean, the last 6 months, of course, it's inflicted a deliberate famine on the people of Gaza, which is the war crime of starvation. I mean, there have been many other allegations of serious crimes by Israeli forces over the last 6 months. So I think if all countries should do better to enforce international humanitarian law, not only against Israel. And you're absolutely right, David, that of course there's lots of double standards in international politics, where states treat some countries lightly and don't do enough to enforce international law generally against lots of countries. And we all know the reasons for that. Sometimes it's about trade or the economy or politics, other kinds of diplomatic relations. So as an international lawyer myself, someone interested in the impartial enforcement of international law everywhere, I absolutely encourage all countries to do more in enforcing international law everywhere. Every step we can take to improve that enforcement, including this suggestion of a special advisor, is positive from my standpoint. If Israel's got nothing to fear, it shouldn't worry about Australia taking a look at its investigation.
Seems to be really overblowing the situation. If one compares other instances that have occurred, and this has been highlighted in the media, like we can look at the Kunduz hospital airstrike in 2015, which is on a scale far, far worse than this. We've seen also how Germany has in its federal court concluded in 2010 that a Taliban convoy that was targeted with 142 civilian deaths did not amount to a war crime, as there was no intention shown. So this seems to me to be really taking a very, very pointy attack for something which doesn't measure on a scale compared to these other incidents that were really not treated in the same way with so much attention.
Look, I think you have to look at every incident on its own merits. Of course, sometimes mistakes in targeting are made under international humanitarian law. And just for your listeners, I mean, the obligation under international law is to do everything feasible to verify what the thing is before you launch an attack on it. So to check that it's a military target, it's not civilian. Also to check that the attack would not cause excessive civilian casualties. Now, sometimes you do all the right things. You look for all the information you need, you double check, you get information from electronic sources or drone footage or informants on the ground, and mistakes can still happen. Now, in those circumstances, there is no violation of international humanitarian law if it's an honest mistake and you did all the things to check in advance. I think the appointment of the special advisor is because the government must have some doubt about whether the Israeli forces did do enough in checking what those targets were, given that Israel attacked three vehicles on the basis that it suspected there might be two militants in three vehicles, which, of course, as you know, could carry at least 15 people. So there could well have been carloads full of civilians, whether they're aid workers or just Palestinians. Doesn't matter. They're all still protected civilians. And so if you do launch an attack in those circumstances, it raises real doubt about what was the information you relied on to believe that they were Hamas fighters. What was the information you relied on to believe that the cars had no civilians in them, that you were also going to kill if you launched that strike? And I think the fact that we haven't enforced international humanitarian law well in other conflicts, and in that I'd include Afghanistan, I'd include the Western Air campaign against ISIS in Syria and Iraq some years ago as well, is also, to my mind, shocking. I mean, we should enforce that better. I think Australia's doing not so bad in that it's at least set up a serious office to investigate and prosecute potential war crimes by Australian special forces in Afghanistan. That's something the Americans haven't done, the British haven't done, when there have been pretty serious allegations about some of their conduct in those conflicts as well. So, look, there's a long way to go in the enforcement of international humanitarian law. And as I said, every little step we can take to improve it, including to give justice to the victims, because, of course, they're the ones we shouldn't lose sight of in all of this, is a positive thing.
Now, there have been about 200 aid workers that have been killed in Gaza, as you would know. Australia hasn't really made any particular statements or concerns about them, and only now people are highlighting the deaths of these other aid workers. Now, these aid workers would have been largely complicit with Hamas, and that's why they would have been targeted. So this seems to be a really not proper handling or measuring of the weight of these different circumstances. Why would we be looking at the deaths of aid workers and other people who are working in Gaza who are actually complicit with Hamas? Why should we have any special sympathy for people who are working with Hamas? Do you let them off the hook? Because I believe you don't believe that Hamas is even a terrorist organization.
So, look, there are a lot of assumptions in what you just said, David. Let me work through them. Firstly, foreign governments have a special interest under international law in protecting their own citizens when they are injured by a foreign state. That's just a rule of international law, which has always been there. So governments are allowed to make diplomatic representations to other governments they suspect of harming their citizens. Of course, if an Australian citizen is at risk, whether it's an Australian in Guantanamo Bay or Julian Assange or, you know, all of the cases we know where sometimes governments say things to other countries, of course they're going to do that. That's their job, and that's a right under international law, as Israel looks after its own citizens in other countries when they're put at risk as well. So I don't think there's anything unusual about that. Secondly, a point I would make is one I've already made publicly, which is I absolutely think it's in some ways really unfortunate that it takes the killing of foreign nationals for foreign governments to get interested in Israeli potential war crimes in Gaza. On the 200 aid workers you mentioned, I'm not sure the circumstances of all of those, because, of course, each incident is different. Some may have been deliberately targeted. I don't know. I haven't looked at those figures. Some might be just aid workers who are civilians killed in their homes along with their families, because that's also been how many people have died in Gaza. So it's a question of whether some were targeted or some were just incidental civilian casualties of other Israeli operations. Your assumption that they must be complicit with Hamas, I utterly reject. I think that's a smear on humanitarian actors in Gaza. You know, these are people who put their lives on the line in order to feed and clothe and shelter and give medicine to civilians in an utterly catastrophic humanitarian situation. So the last 6 months, and this is on Israel. Let me finish. The last 6 months, at present, there are 600,000 people on the verge of starvation. There are 1.1 million people who are facing chronic hunger, and the rest of the population is facing acute hunger. So these aid workers, yes, of course, they some of them, if they were working with the Hamas authorities, yes, they had an association with Hamas. It was the government. I mean, somebody had to run the place after Israel left. That's not to say you support Hamas. It's just the fact of how the place was being run. That doesn't make them terrorists. I mean, if you're working for the Hamas authority, feeding people, or you're a doctor in a Palestinian hospital in Gaza, that doesn't make you a dangerous Hamas terrorist. That makes you somebody who's doing your job in a civilian administration. Your assumption that I don't think Hamas is a terrorist organization, I've never said that. What people need to be very clear about is what I have said, which is that there is no definition of terrorist organization under international law. There are definitions under national law. So Israel says Hamas is a terrorist organization. Australia says Hamas is a terrorist organization. That's up to them. You know, they make the law. I don't make the law. I don't make international law. The Security Council has not listed Hamas as a terrorist organization. So and most countries in the world have not listed Hamas as a terrorist organization. So that's not me, David. That's countries, and that's international law, which has not agreed what terrorism is for all kinds of political reasons. My job, I've been appointed by the United Nations to monitor human rights when states counter terrorism. So if Israel calls Hamas a terrorist organization, my job is to ensure Israel respects human rights when countering terrorism. I've got no authority and no power myself to make up some kind of international law which says Hamas is a terrorist organization. So this kind of gotcha stuff which people play in the media, trying to force people to name Hamas as a terrorist organization, I think is really quite unhelpful. I've also said, and this is very clear, that Hamas has committed very serious war crimes on a systematic scale. War crimes are defined under international law. Terrorism is not. War crimes are international crimes under international law. So if you want to call Hamas the worst thing under international law, call them war criminals, because that's what they are. There is no category of terrorism. So I don't know why people are fixated on this labeling of an organization as terrorist or not, when actually it's not as bad as calling them war criminals, which is what I have always said since October 7.
But you have opposed the Australian government prescribing Hamas as a terrorist organization. And given what Hamas committed on October the 7th, it would be, I think, evident to anybody who has got any kind of common sense that Hamas has behaved like a terrorist organization in the act that they carried out. So wouldn't that have changed your mind and what you thought perhaps a couple of years ago?
Again, David, what you've just said is a total misrepresentation of the submission I made to a parliamentary inquiry, which was to say that if you do classify Hamas as a terrorist organization, because of the criminal offences under Australian law, which flow from that listing of a group as terrorist, it means that you suddenly criminalise all kinds of innocent civilian activity connected with the Hamas administration in Gaza. So if you're a rubbish collector for Hamas under that listing, that's the crime of association with a terrorist organisation. If you provide medical care or assistance in a hospital to civilians, you're not a fighter, you're not violent, you're not trying to hurt anybody, including Israelis, that makes you a terrorist under Australian law. Now, that's clearly unprincipled, inappropriate, excessive. It punishes ordinary civilians and the ordinary civilian population. And I would never say that that is appropriate for Australian law to do that. I never opposed, and if you read my submission, which you clearly have not done, if you read the submission, you'll see that I did not take any position about classifying Hamas as a terrorist organization in principle. The problem is that the sum of the criminal offences which flow from that designation are excessive. So my argument was simply that Australia should not criminalise ordinary civilian activity, and I think most sensible people would agree with that position.
Now, you've considered civilian objects to retain protected status even when used for military purposes. Now, we know Hamas has been using civilians as human shields in...
David, I have never said that. If you can send me where I've said that, I'd be very surprised.
Well, I think you said that on X and on March 28th.
That's a complete misrepresentation, David. I'm an international humanitarian lawyer. I have always said if something is used for a military purpose, it can be a military objective. But the second step under international humanitarian law, and these are rules which Israel itself has agreed to, is that you cannot attack a military objective if it would cause excessive civilian casualties. So even if it is a military objective, yes, sometimes you can't attack it because there's a second rule. And if you don't understand that that's how humanitarian law works, and again, you take this kind of cheap gotcha approach, then of course you're going to misrepresent what people say, and you'll misrepresent what international law says.
Isn't this a nonsense of international law that it works on this principle of proportionality, which can be interpreted in any old which way?
Look, I agree with you that unfortunately the proportionality rule is, of course, open to potential abuse and excessive interpretations which are not in the spirit of international humanitarian law. And I think we see that in Gaza. Israel is interpreting the proportionality rule clearly in a manner which is excessive, tolerating many more civilian casualties than other like-minded democracies would ordinarily tolerate. I mean, there was a story last week about Israel in the early phases of the war potentially allowing the killing of 15 to 20 civilians in order to kill one member of Hamas, and not a senior leader, just a regular Hamas fighter. You can kill their whole family and all their relatives. And Israel was doing that on multiple occasions in the opening stages of the war. So yes, some states do clearly abuse international humanitarian law. But what's the alternative, David? I mean, if you can come up with a better rule, the rule says you cannot cause excessive civilian casualties relative to the military advantage. So the point of the rule is to say if the military objective is really, really important, you could potentially allow a greater number of civilian casualties. If it's not particularly important, like a Hamas foot soldier at home with his family, not in the middle of a military operation where there's no particular urgency to target that person, absolutely not. You cannot murder 20 civilians in order to eliminate that one soldier. So it's on governments to do the right thing. Governments have made that rule. Israel was part of making that rule. Israel supports that rule, and it's for Israel to respect that rule.
You've accused Israel of not doing enough to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian aid to Palestinian civilians in Gaza. You said earlier when we spoke about Israel using starvation as a weapon of war. Now, Israel's task in Gaza is to eliminate Hamas and not to be primarily concerned about the needs of the civilian population. So Israel is facilitating other organisations coming into Gaza to do that job. That's its obligation, nothing more, nothing less. I think Israel, by organisations that are antipathetic to Israel, they're using this as a weapon to criticise Israel when Israel is doing everything within its means, given the fact that its primary concern there is to eliminate Hamas, and these concerns about humanitarian aid are only making it more difficult.
Look, once again, David, I disagree with some of the assumptions you make there. So when you fight a war, it is an obligation to ensure that you fight the war in a way which protects civilians as much as possible. That includes in the facilitation or direct delivery of humanitarian relief. So in terms of humanitarian relief, you know, for the last 6 months, if Israel were doing enough, you would not have 2.3 million people facing acute food shortages. You would not have around 30 children already dying of malnutrition. In the north of Gaza at the moment, right now, there are about 30% of children are suffering from severe wasting. That means emaciation. The chief reason why civilians in Gaza have been starving is because of Israeli policy. Now, you're right that Israel itself doesn't necessarily have to deliver the food itself, but it has to get out of the way and allow others to do it. And it has not been doing that. The latest figures from the United Nations suggest that since 7 October, so in the last 6 months, only about one quarter of the total daily truckload of relief supplies over that period have got into Gaza, in a context where civilian infrastructure, food production facilities, etc., have been largely destroyed across Gaza. So the population can't fend for themselves. So they're more reliant than they were before October 7 on international relief. The number of or the amount of food relief getting in is a quarter of what it used to be when the Gaza Strip was functioning in an ordinary civilian way. Just to give you figures from the last few weeks, in North Gaza, the UN figures show that only 16% of the population was reached by food distribution. It's a bit better in the middle, so it's about 45% in the middle of Gaza, and in Rafah, in the south, it's about 30%. But that tells you that most of the population is still not getting the food it needs. And if they are reached, it's not reached at the level you need to prevent the kind of starvation, hunger, malnutrition that we're seeing across that area. Now, it's got a little bit better in the last few weeks because of US pressure. Unfortunately, Israel did not comply with the multiple orders of the International Court of Justice, which are legally binding under international law, to let more food aid in. It didn't respect the United Nations Security Council demanding a ceasefire so that humanitarian aid could get into the territory. And of course, it's been shutting down UNRWA, which is one of the largest humanitarian relief providers in the Gaza Strip, because of what it says are its security concerns. But of course, if you do that and you don't provide an alternative, then you starve people even more. Look, this was clearly announced by Israel at the start of the campaign when the defense minister said, we will not let humanitarian relief supplies into Gaza. And this has been a policy of Israel to starve people over the past 6 months.
Well, the number of trucks coming in is not a measure of how much food aid is getting in, because before October the 7th, the number of trucks were bringing in much more than just food aid. Now they're bringing in exclusively that type of aid, so you can't measure the number of trucks today compared to what was coming in before as any indication of the amount of food aid that's arriving to help Gazans.
Well, David, people weren't starving on this scale 6 months ago. So something has changed. And what has changed is that there is a chronic lack of food getting into Gaza. Also, I would also add that we've only been talking so far about the duty to allow humanitarian relief to get in. Of course, most countries in the world still regard Gaza as occupied territory. If you took that view, then, of course, as the occupying power, Israel does have an obligation to provide food itself directly to the people, and to provide security for the provision of food aid. And so Israel clearly hasn't been doing that. Not only that, it's in some cases been firing on crowds receiving food aid. It's sometimes fired on humanitarian relief workers and convoys. So it's not just not positively providing food, it's killing people who've been trying to provide it and deliberately obstructing food aid. So look, this is not the Israeli democracy respectful of human rights, which I would like to see, as I'm sure many people in Israel would like to see. You know, in the old days before international humanitarian law developed over the last 100-150 years, it was okay to starve civilians as a tactic of war. This was a medieval tactic. You could surround a city that was your adversary and just starve everybody into submission so they gave up or all got diseased and died. Modern humanity doesn't accept that. And so I think it is a real shock to everybody that this is a tactic which a democracy like Israel, which says it's concerned about international law and human rights and being the most moral army in the world, to see Israel falling from its aspirations as a democracy, I think is really quite shocking.
Well, your views don't agree with those of John Spencer, who's a retired United States Army officer, who has said that Israel is painstakingly followed the laws of armed conflict and implemented many steps to prevent civilian casualties. Despite the enormous challenges that it faces in this urban warfare situation. And I must say that I take anything that comes from the United Nations with a grain of salt, because the United Nations has shown an incomparable animus towards Israel throughout its history, ever since I think the mid-70s, when we saw horrendous motions passed in the United Nations declaring Zionism as a form of racism, which now the Palestinian movement has taken up with great glory.
Look, David, the United Nations is a very large and diverse organization. It has lots of different parts, and I can tell you that the humanitarian relief organizations on the ground in Gaza are not responsible for any of those things you've just described, even if they were true. We're talking here about the World Food Programme, the World Health Organization, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. You know, these are neutral, impartial humanitarian actors. They're not political actors. They're not the Security Council. They're not the General Assembly. They're not bodies of states. They're technical humanitarian actors trying to do their job to stop people dying of hunger. So I don't think it's fair to try to tarnish, everybody in the UN system because somehow, 40 years ago, some resolution was passed which was critical of Israel. I mean, that's just, again, smearing the whole organization when there are really good and ethical people trying to do their job in the midst of bombardment, putting their lives on the line to feed people because Israel itself is not prepared to do that. So I think that's a really unfair characterization of the United Nations. If what John Spencer says is right, then why is almost every government in the world concerned about the way Israel is fighting this war? You know, Israel's closest allies, the United States, which has been providing political cover for almost anything Israel does over many decades, has been critical of Israel. The US president has been pushing Israel to respect international humanitarian law because they clearly believe Israel is not doing that. If people want to be apologists for Israel, to think that, Israel can never do anything wrong or never violate international law, that's for them to live in their own little fantasy world, but it's certainly not accurate.
Yeah, I think the Biden administration is very concerned about the elections coming up at the end of the year, and that's what's driving them in their decision-making. And I do have to mention a couple of UN organisations. We've gone past UNRWA. UNRWA has been very effective at perpetuating the conflict ever since it was formed after 1948. And UNESCO, in terms of its ability to not recognise the Israeli entitlements to the land that it has in biblical heritage and archaeological evidence, and putting somehow the rights of Palestinians to some kind of a heritage that is manufactured is also quite beyond the pale. So there are many arms or agents or actors of the United Nations that are all following the same anti-Israel pattern.
So look, David, you invited me on your show to talk about humanitarian relief in Gaza, and this is going well beyond that. Look, I'm not a UN official. I'm an independent expert outside the UN who has authority from the Human Rights Council to monitor human rights in every country. That's my job. I don't think there is some big conspiracy in all of the United Nations against Israel. That's just not how it works, from what I've seen in the organization. I think there are larger issues at work than whatever missteps particular United Nations entities may have made over the years. The root of all of this is that Israelis have a right to a state. Palestinians have a right to a state. Palestinians have been waiting over 70 years for theirs. Until that happens, this cycle of violence will never stop. Members of Hamas didn't just wake up one day and decide it would be great to just start killing Israelis. There's a background to this. This comes from, yes, there are elements of anti-Semitism, of course, and I always condemn those. But the ultimately there needs to be a political resolution to this conflict. Israel can't hang on to Palestinian land forever. Now, I know parts of Israeli politics would like to do that. I know the settlers would like to do that, but that's illegal under international law. When Israel was founded in 1948, it didn't claim the West Bank. It didn't claim Gaza. It recognized that there was a legitimate right for Palestinians to have their own state. Now, since then, unfortunately, because of politics in Israel and because the international community has let Israel get away with it, settlers have been illegally taking bits of Palestine every year for many, many years. And of course, Palestinians, you know, won't accept that. I mean, Israelis would not accept that if Palestinians were setting up settlements in Tel Aviv and excluding Israelis from
I've got to interrupt
from
you.
Their territory.
We're almost out of time in a minute. I just wanted to say that Palestine is disputed territory. There's never been a sovereign state of Palestine. The world didn't give much of a concern about a Palestinian state between 48 and 67 when Jordan had control over that area, and which wasn't recognized by anybody else except, I think, one other country. So Israel has offered a state to the Palestinians on multiple occasions that has been knocked back. I think Israel's done a fair share in terms of its attempting to make some kind of a peace arrangement with the Palestinians, but it just hasn't happened. And I thank you, Ben.
And David, let me since you've raised another set of issues, let me answer that one very briefly. I know we're out of time.
You'll have a chance. You'll be cut off. If you really want to answer it properly, we'll need to resume this Zoom session by logging out and logging back in again, because we've got less than 30 seconds to go according to the clock here.
Yeah, well, look, let's finish up there. But then if you wouldn't mind editing out that last bit, since I didn't get a chance to respond to it, I think if you're interviewing me rather than making statements,
I interviewed you anyway in any context. I don't think it serves any purpose to remove. I didn't have enough chance to respond to many things you said either. I gave you the chance without really interrupting you, Ben. So I think it's all.
No, okay, David. But you know, you did say you'd ask me about two issues, and then you raised a whole lot of other ones, which were completely outside what I'd agreed to talk to you about. So I don't think that's very ethical journalism. But thanks anyway.